things. So David's visiting us today. So David, I just want to introduce a little. I'm not sure where to start. David has a huge career in system sciences. Worked for IBM for years. He's working, working on PhD material in Finland. He's part of the systems group, the systems thinking groups. He's kind of helped us in many ways on all aspects of systems. He's kind of really knowledgeable. You can kind of search out some of his material on LinkedIn and Wikipedia. He's actually got a lot of services from science material there. There's lots of articles. We asked him to come in today and talk. One of the areas that he really brings together is service systems and organizational kind of systems from that point of view and system sciences. So that's kind of what we asked him to talk about. And I'm sure you'll have lots of questions as we go through. But I don't know what else to say. Like, it's so extensive. I don't know where to start. But you will see, as you go through the material, if you have specific questions, you'll see that there'll be lots of places. I will post, I think it's already up. I'm not sure. We've posted it. It should be under this module for today, so you can follow along with his slide presentation. And I'm sure you'll want to give them a lot more information about your life, okay, your life journey. I'm just going to get some markers.
Okay, thanks. If you kill the lights.
Yeah.
And I'll kill the lights.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Did you just need dry erase?
Yeah.
Oh, just carry. Wow, what a resourceful glass.
I told you, this glass is really
let's carry. With the eraser. Now, that's really, really impressive. So the slide deck you have is missing one slide, and so coevolving.com/commons/publications.
Can you say that again?
Coevolving.com. /commons/publications, where I keep all my content.
Thank you.
And I'm also on Twitter at David Ng, if you want to know where I am. That's easy to find. So it's always a great opportunity for me to come and speak to classes. And Jeremy was talking about how much I have on the web. I was saying that the reason that I can actually do research is I don't have to do any teaching. Which is a really interesting thing. So what you actually see on the web page, and I record these talks, I put them on YouTube and things like that, is because when I come to classes, actually present what I'm working on at that point. So if you had come to this class, like I didn't lecture last year, but the year before that, like 3 years, I lectured. And I was presenting content that I had first presented at Related System Thinking and Design class, which was about what systems thinkers, what designers should know about systems thinking. And so since then, I've been working on my PhD. This is the, people complain about how long it takes to get to grad school. And I started at Aalto University in Finland in 2003. I was visiting with a friend, and he was teaching a class in Finland, and I went to help him. They asked if I wanted to teach in Finland, and I said, oh, that'd be great. And my friend said, well, you might as well finish your PhD while you're here. And so I applied and became this PhD student in Finland, and it was a very strange PhD because I got called in by a director of grad studies, and he said, we know you're not progressing on your PhD very quickly. And I said, yeah, well, I'm not in a real hurry because, I have a full-time job at IBM, and my goal is to finish my PhD before I retire. And he says, in Finland, we can get you student funding. And I said, I doubt your funding is better than I do salary. And he said, good, take your time, it's fine. I was in the PhD program the first time between 1982 and 1984 at University of British Columbia. For those of you who are up on your reading and have read Michael Lewis's The Undoing Project about Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, there's a section where they talk about Kahneman being at UBC and Tversky flying up every other weekend. I was part of that period, and so I had a class with Danny Kahneman. So for people who are complaining about how long it takes to a PhD, I started my PhD in 1982. So the result is I've had this career where I've always been part of half in the field and half in academia. I started IBM in 1985, and I started off doing econometrics at IBM, economics and headquarters. I have this joke at IBM. My plan was, and my actual career route, I started at the top of the company, and I worked my way all the way down. And when I got to the bottom, they threw me out. Because at that point, I was doing technical sales in the field. But in around 1990, I helped found a research center at the University of Toronto called the Canadian Center for Marketing Information Technologies. And this is when supermarket scanner was first coming up. So at that point, as I was telling Jeremy, we had this whole field of marketing science. And marketing science was the challenge when they had all the supermarket scanner data. We had people that, one, understood marketing, two, understood statistics, and three, nothing about computers. And now we have this field called data science. And data science is, one, people that understand marketing, two, understand computers, and three, understand nothing about statistics. So now it's like I'm teaching statistics, so in a couple of weeks I'm going to China. It's like teaching statistics. It's like, I did this in 1985. Like, it's kind of like sticking on the ground. So this talk, and it'll be interesting comparing what I do today versus what I do yesterday, because the slides are the same, but the content wandered all over the place. So the question that I've asked myself is, okay, so you are a design student, you're a master design, and what does he know about systems thinking? And in the research I'm doing now, it's service systems thinking, and I'll explain what that actually means. And what happened in the other talk I used to give, where I give theoretical sorts of snippets about what it is in systems thinking that is not in other fields, because system thinking is really interdisciplinary. It's designed interdisciplinary, and actually what upsets me, when I may or may not go to the ISSS meeting this year, is when people take systems thinking and they make it a discipline. Because as soon as you make it a discipline, it loses its value. But the world wants us to be disciplinary, so we end up having to be what popularly called T-shaped people. You have to be deep in one field, and you have to be broad across the others. When you have that crossbar in the T, how is it that you actually get that breadth and maintain a depth? And the challenge you have there is the communication across all of those disciplines. So I fell into systems around 1999. There's a book called Adaptive Enterprise by Steve Peckle. And I was assigned at that point at IBM to go and work with Steve as he was writing that book. The province we actually had this called the Advanced Business Institute at IBM was a place where IBM would give free education to executives. And the joke was, if you were a CFO that became a CIO, this is where you went to learn to push a mouse. Because at that point, like, a mouse was new, and people weren't doing PC and stuff like that. So, but that's what it was. And so Steve Heckel, when he was forming the book, he came up with all these assertions. Some of the assertions were like, the primary constituent for an enterprise is its customers, not shareholders. And they go, okay, Steve, I got an MBA, Milton Friedman, shareholders are, driving. He goes, no. And he made these same assertions with such certainty. It's like, well, how does he know this stuff? So that's when he went, that's when he said, you need to go read some Russ Acuff. And Russ Acuff, you've been reading Chomsky and Garrett Doggy's work. Chomsky worked with Russ Acuff. So that's the tie. I do a lot of history of science with all these people kind of tie in together, and that's how the ideas flow. So when Steve, after I started going to conferences, I fell into the systems community and had the single best educational experience of my life within the systems community. Steve Heckel came back and he said, the conference kind of like this. So Steve's writing like this, and at this point it's kind of like, oh, this is how the book should go. And I said, I said, Steve, I don't understand this part because you say this, but Russ Acuff says this. And at which point he said, I told you to go read Russ Acuff, not become Russ Acuff. So the thing I'll warn you about the readings that you've done, and I've seen the readings that I kind of have a sense of what you've been doing. Russ Acuff and those ideas are not all systems thinking. The reason that Russ Acuff is very, very good for people who are getting into system thinking is because he is extremely clear. My friend David Hawk, who I mentioned multiple times in this talk, was Russ Acuff's first PhD student, and said that Russ wrote the same book 23 times. So, and you know, you get kind of crusty after you don't get your message, but it's actually somewhat true that he'd written it that way. But what happens in generally, if we have enough time, and you'll find this in my talk, is I spend half of the time building you up to Russ Acuff and you getting the ideas. And then I spend the other half of the talk tearing down Russ Acuff and saying, well, okay, you learned all this stuff, now I understand all that, great, you understand that. Okay, now what if it isn't true? What if there's another way of looking at the world? So this talk had actually gone a lot farther on that because of a couple of things that were going on. One, I've been working on a PhD, and so I'm actually in the last part of my last chapter, I've had to explain a lot of stuff. So for those of you who you hear the name Gregory Bateson, I've moved from being an Acuff guy to being a Bateson guy, which in the systems community is like, really? It's a big jump. The other part is that in trying to get practical, and this isn't in my dissertation, I've been working a lot on a generative pattern language, and so the final paper for that I presented in October. This is work that's in an architecture community. So I was presenting at the Perl conference, I met some of the original people that have been doing work since the 1970s. And so it took me 3 years to get enough gumption, I guess, or background to do that, because I was presenting at the Pattern of the Plot conference, which is a computer science conference, presented at a Perlsaw conference, which is a social change conference, then presented similar content and finalizing it in pattern language. So what I want you to do and think about and what you're doing in your work, your thesis work, is I want you to think about reflecting on the acts of representation. And what do I mean by that? Let's take that apart. So when I talk about representation, I'm talking about what you're presenting to other people and the way you're presenting to other people. Now, in order for you to present to other people and commit that act, what's going to happen is that you start bringing your biases, your point of view, into the way that other people hear what you're talking about. So, a representation. Russ Acuff's representation of the world. If I come in, I cite Acuff, and people who know and have read Acuff, I go, oh, okay, I know that. And then someone says, what am I doing this way? And I go, well, that's actually someone else's model. So Bateson looks at the world this way, Acuff looks at it this way, and either I know Bateson, but right now we're in Acuff's camp. So for me, a lot of system is history of science because there are so many different streams. I forgot to mention yesterday in last class, but Peter brought it up. There's a group here called System Thinking Ontario. We meet in the Lambert Lounge every third Wednesday of the month. System Thinking Ontario is a spin-off from the International Society of System Sciences because Toronto is a system thinking hub and people don't really think about that. I'll give you the best example, who is Elena Leonard. Elena Leonard was president of the International Society of System Sciences. She was the president of the American Society for Cybernetics. The cybernetics are different than the systems community. Plus, she was Stafford Beer's life partner and lives up in the annex. And the reason we started System Thinking Ontario, Peter was running Design with Dialogue, but we started System Thinking Ontario because Elena and I would never meet in Toronto. I would see Elena in Vienna, I'd see her in Tokyo, I'd see her all around the world, and we'd never see each other in Toronto. I said, you know, there's something wrong here. So we started this program where we just have a meeting every month, and the topic changes, it doesn't matter, we don't all show up at the same time. But even York University, the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University, people don't understand, that is one of the world's leading places for system sciences. because when you're talking environmental studies, it's system and environment. It's not environmental science, it's environmental studies. But people don't appreciate that. So we've got York University uptown, we've got this program, which is, you know, around Peter's work, our latest thinking design, and at U of T, we've also got work with Steve Easterbrook, and the people will talk to each other. We go off to Vienna, we meet in Vienna, we never meet here. So trying to bring these groups together, we have all these different points of view. Now, Elena is someone I respect a lot, and she respects me. We come from like really, really different points of view in the systems community. So when someone says they're doing a Stafford Beer approach, kind of, okay, biosystems model, integrations, all this methods, all this sort of stuff, and it's a way of approaching it. And if you have a problem where you want to work on something, I find that works really well in diagnosis. The biosystems model is great for diagnosis. It's not so great, I find, for prescription normally stuff. So when we're talking here about reflecting, what I'm doing now is reflecting to you what I'm representing. I'm saying that, okay, this is currently David Ng's view of what systems thinking is, and particular services thinking. It is not the only view of the world. And your view will change a little bit and shift with that. So I'm going to cover five topics. And I'm already like way off from what I did yesterday. And we're probably going to get through four of them. So I didn't have this long preamble yesterday. We got through four of them. But I want you to, I'll try to get through this, these ideas. So the first one, I'll give you a little hint here, and this is a little thing, is since I do have this background, I'm not a computer scientist, but I've spent my whole career around computer science people, representation is really important to me. So when you see that little thing in the middle, some of those are singles, headed arrows, and some are double-headed arrows. And that's a very, very subtle sort of thing that someone will look at, and most people won't pay attention to it, but it's kind of like, no, I mean it. And you kind of go, well, what's that mean? Well, okay, let's talk about that. So let's first talk about architecting and designing. What's the difference between architecting and designing? Why aren't you guys in architecture programs? So you want to be an architecture program, but this is what you mean, yeah.
So what kind of architecture do you mean, buildings or computer architecture?
Good question.
Because I'm an enterprise architect, like computers, but
okay.
Not buildings.
Great, since I was a business architect at IBM, the question is business architecture a subdiscipline of enterprise architecture, or is enterprise architecture a subdiscipline of business architecture?
Usually it's arranged so that the business architecture is
under
the
yes, exactly.
That doesn't mean it's the right way to do it. It's just the way you usually answer.
Yeah, I know. But I spent a whole career with that. And then someone asked, well, doesn't business architecture do what enterprise architecture do? And I say, do you do organization design? You go, no. Okay, well, I do organization design. So but that's a great example, because what's happened is these ideas of architecture have permeated across fields. So in computers, we have architecture. And people talk about this sort of thing every day. But what I'm going to do is present a slightly different view on that, which is this idea that goes back to 1969 in the architecture community. And so in architecture, they had this distinction between problem-seeking and problem-solving. Architectural programming, architecture, in essence, was problem-seeking. Design was problem-solving. Okay? So if you start reading a lot of architecture, every once in a while you run across these really weird architects who only do really bizarre projects. Like, they want to build a building on the side of a mountain that won't fall off. People go, you're crazy to do that. And what they're doing is that they're seeking a problem that's sufficiently hard to make it worth doing. Okay? So when you are doing your presentation, and when you're doing your analysis work on your projects, the question is, should you actually be focused on the problem seeking or the problem solving? If you're focused on problem seeking, there are lots of problems in the world. And you'll see very soon I'm going to have a problem with the word problem. But there are a lot of problems in the world, and you can't solve all of them. So if you are architecting, is it possible to separate that part out, or is it part of the same thing? So, All architecture is design, but not all design is architecture. You want that quote? That's like from Brady Booch. That's good. People who are in computer science. So the way that I would frame this is architectural thinking is shaping the structure of the environment. That's one way of looking at it. Now, design thinking, since that's a new term, you can go with the standard idea sort of thing, but idea of divergent steps, creating choices, and convergent steps, making choices. Let's dig a little bit deeper. There are a few people who write about architecture in systems. And so I introduced two ideas to you. One is autopoiesis, and the other is allopoiesis. Now, if anyone has been around knowledge management, you may hear the term autopoiesis, which came from Maturana Morella. Maturana is part of the systems community, the biologist of Chile. And the idea of autopoiesis, poiesis is creating or making. Auto means self-making, right? So living systems are autopoietic, which means they're self-organizing and self-generating. Human beings, you know, your human body creates cells and it generates, so it reorganizes itself automatically, it regenerates, and that's where Maturana started. It'll also apply, we talk about living systems, to social systems, extend into that, that people are in effect self-organizing and self-generating. You can compare that to assembly lines that are allopoietic, and an assembly line has like packages coming off the end. You're building a car. The car comes off. The car looks nothing like the assembly line. So you're designing an allopoietic system that is externally organized and externally generated. Now, we could talk about an era where robots actually create more robots like themselves, which would make it autopoietic. But when we talk about living things, we end up with this distinction about whether it's living or non-living. So living systems, here's a pretty rigorous definition. Now, if you are in design thinking, are you in the phase where you can actually make the distinction that you're going to have something that's either allopoietic or autopoietic? Or are you outside of that? So one of the examples I have, my friend David Hawk, doing his PhD under Russ Akoff in the 1970s, was working on the problem of environmental regulation. This is in the early days of EPA when it started coming into power. And what he was looking at was, can you design a governance system that is self-governing, self-maintaining? Because the way that most laws are built is they come in and they're really allopoietic. It's like, we have this law, don't do this. And it's like, how do you enforce that? Okay, so we have the travel ban coming in from Trump, and he announced it over a weekend, right? It's like, everyone's scrambling, it's like, how do we do this? Can you create something that is self-reinforcing? So David was instrumental in what became the Energy Star program. The simple discussion of the description of the Energy Star program is, you have a refrigerator, you walk to the refrigerator, on the refrigerator is a sticker that says, this refrigerator uses this much power, and over this many years, it's going to cost you this much electricity. Beside it, there's another refrigerator, and the other refrigerator, hey, this refrigerator is $100 cheaper. But, you know, I can look at these two stickers, and it's like, it's $100 cheaper, but in 2 years, the refrigerator is going to be better buy. That is an example of a self-reinforcing system. It did not require government regulation to do that. The Energy Star program came out of the Manufacturers Association, and so they enforce it themselves. So can we create systems that are self-generating, self-reinforcing? That is an architectural issue much more than it is a design issue. Because after you've got it, it's kind of like, okay, how are we going to, you know, make sure these people are actually posting the correct statistics on power use, that sort of stuff. That's sort of the view of design work. But architecture work takes you a next step up. How many of you have heard of Stuart Brand's How Buildings Learn? Okay. Here's your homework. Go to YouTube. There is How Buildings Learn, a 6-part BBC series. And The origins of this is Stuart Brand. He leads a foundation now called the Long Now Foundation, which was started with Brian Eno and other people. But his background goes back into Ken Kesey and the Mary Pranksters, all sorts of stuff. So the question was really asked. This is written in the period around organizational learning and knowledge management. And what he wanted to study was knowledge. But knowledge is abstract, and there's not a lot of history on it. If you actually want to study something, he said, well, let's do this. Let's study buildings. And so he did this work called How Buildings Learn. Now, when you talk about that, it's a little bit strange, because what does it mean by building learning? So the usual way we think about buildings is we have the people, and we have the building around the people who inhabit it, right? That's a conventional way of thinking about it. But when you're in system thinking, you can invert that, because learning is adaptation to an environment. So as opposed to saying that people are the system and the building is the environment, what happens if we look instead at if the building is a system and the people are the environment? Okay. We start off with this bottom, the site. The site is the slowest changing part of a system. It's really hard to move a site. And if you actually want, you know, very rarely, it's always big news when someone takes a whole building and moves the whole building, puts it on a jack and a truck and drives somewhere else, because site is so difficult. The second thing that comes is structure. Structure is load-bearing walls. Outside the structure, you then work on the skin, which is to protect the structure. The only place that that really does this backwards is the Pompidou Center in Paris, if you've been there, and they have all the plumbing and ducting on the outside. It's a really bad idea, because you get corrosion in the ductwork, and then you have to fix that, and so you end up having to put a second skin outside your structure and your services. So inside the structure, you have services. This is the venting, electrical, plumbing, all that sort of stuff. And that goes in after you put in the structure, because you end up having to mount electrical fixtures against the stud, that sort of stuff. You have the space plan. Space plan is non-load-bearing walls. You can decide about that, but you can't decide about putting in non-load-bearing walls until you put in the plumbing, because is it load-bearing, not load-bearing, you go through that or not. Space plan, the sort of thing you do is you look at this wall and you go, we need a bigger room. Can we go through that wall? It's like, well, is there any venting going through there? Is there plumbing going through there? If there's plumbing going through there, and you have to move the plumbing, it's going to be a lot of work. So the last thing is stuff, which is furniture, mobilia. Mobilia, because it's stuff that moves. So the difference between a closet and an armoire, because they both store clothes, a closet, when you move, you can't take it with you. It's part of the space plan. And if you're changing places and there's not enough closets, you end up buying an armoire, you can take that with you, you may or may not use it. So you make all these sorts of things. Now these make these decisions. Now the reason that this is an interesting way of looking at buildings is that it has this mixture between structure and process. Because you can actually see how layers change over time. So originally this was called a shearing layers approach. He since adapted it, now it's called a pacing layers approach. But this is helpful in thinking through, when you're architecting stuff, do you move stuff from one layer to another layer? Okay, I'm going to talk about now a little bit on service systems. Because a lot of what you've been thinking about and looking at are production systems. And it's a very fine distinction that people miss quite often. So the advent of this idea of service systems came around 2003, and Jim Sporer, who at that point was a researcher at IBM Almaden, was given an interesting opportunity challenge. So those of you who ever track the history of IBM, IBM used to be a hardware company, and then became a software and services company, and then it's like, oh, at one point, it's like IBM, if you look at IBM revenue, half of IBM's revenue is coming from services. Okay, that's interesting. So they go over to IBM Research and go, you know, you guys in research, so if half of our revenue is coming from services, how much are we spending in research and services? And it's like, it's like we do disk drives, we do hardware, you know, all this physics stuff, we move atoms around. It's like, so IBM Research was spending next to nothing on services. And so Jim Sporer, around 2003, said he started this campaign. He said it'd be a 10-year project to start this field of what he called service science, because we don't really understand what's going on. And if you look at developed countries, 70-80% of the economy is services in GDP, if you want to count it that way. So what's happening in our economies if we're using this framing that we are, in the old days, like machines? So the way I like look at this is go a little bit backwards on this, and let's think about what happens in and the different assumptions you get when you're working in a different type of system. So we'll go back to agricultural systems. We'll go back before the Industrial Revolution. So Jeremy is farming. He's actually pretty bad farmer. So Jeremy, I have this factory. I have an offer for you, right? Why don't you come and you work for me? You work 9 to 5. It's warm in the winter. It's cool in the summer with air conditioning. I guarantee you pay, you know, no failed crops, you know. So Jeremy says, oh, that sounds pretty good. I said, okay, you start Monday, 9 o'clock. And Jeremy says, you mean sunrise? No, we work 9 to 5. But there's this problem. In the summer, you lose all that daylight. And then, you know, we live in the Northern Hemisphere. In the winter, I come to work in the dark and I go home in the dark. Why don't we, you know, flex around and, you know, work more in the summer and less in the winter? No, we work 9 to 5, year round. So we have this built-in mentality that comes in the industrial age, which is developed around machines. And been working on shifts, and that's the way the world has evolved, and we all recognize it. I'm in class at 8:30. It's like, why 8:30? Why don't we come to class at 1 o'clock in the afternoon? Why do we do it this way? So now we have this idea of service systems, and we're a service economy. And so the question I ask is, it is midnight, your primary client phones you on your mobile phone. Do you answer the phone? It's not between 9 and 5. Now, this is your client that if this guy is dissatisfied, you are out of the job tomorrow. This is a sign of a service economy. So we're always connected, and we're working on this different time schedule. All these presuppositions come in on a certain economy. So one of the things that happened at IBM, the interesting New York Times article, IBM stopped counting vacation time. Why would you call vacation time? Why do you have vacation time? We need vacation time because people can't work. They don't want people to work until they're dead, right? So you have vacation time. But when IBM actually did the studies, it turns out that IBMers were not taking their full vacation anyway. And so it's kind of like, okay, you have your measurement system. So if you're a salesperson, you have a sales target. If you're a development team, they've got their projects laid out. But we'll do this level, stuff like that. So why is it that you're doing counting hours? Now, I was in consulting. Consulting is the worst one of all this. Consulting still bills by the hour. And so anyone who cracks the problem of not billing by the hour when you're consulting, I made this joke when people in their master's programs want to go to consulting. I said, okay, let me understand this. So you studied, you know, 6 years in university. Before you went to university, you could probably get a job at, you know, minimum wage sort of thing and being paid by the hour. You go to university, you graduate, you go into consulting where you get the opportunity of being paid by the hour. It's like, is something wrong here? So we haven't quite understood this. The thing that I would do, and I did that, you know, I tell everyone at IBM, is that I would work, you know, I actually know how much. When I was a consultant, in consulting to bill 40 hours a week, I'd have to work 56. That's just what happens. Because besides billing the client, it's all this internal stuff you end up doing up on the outside. And so I know that. And so I began scheduling Tuesday afternoons to go for half-price movies with my wife. Because I'm already working more than 40 hours. It's like, geez, come on, guys. So why is it that we have to schedule where we're working 9 to 5? Why don't you schedule, like, everyone, why don't you schedule Tuesday afternoon off? Like, this, you know, there's no reason. Like, why go on Saturday when the theaters are full and they're all busy? Go and take Tuesday afternoon off. That's the way that you could think about a service economy. Now, service systems, and now you're going, well, what the heck are service systems anyway? Jim Spohr was at a meeting in Washington where he's asked, okay, if we're in a service economy and we had to change our primary school system and our secondary school system, how would we do that? How would it be different? And so he suggested, well, okay, we can do from concrete to abstract. We start off with systems that move, store, harvest, and process. So firstly, kindergarten, we teach what transportation systems. Kids, you have to get to school, firstly, so it's like some kids walk, some kids take the bus, some kids get driven to work, so it's like we can already teach them how to get to school. Transportation is a basic sort of thing. Grade 1, we teach them about water and waste management. When you turn on the tap, it's not like water magically appears. You know, water falls from the sky, it goes to the lakes, it goes to filtration, it gets piped through. There's a system that happens there. Food and global supply chain. Food doesn't just show up in the supermarket magically. It doesn't always come wrapped in plastic. How is it? It comes from a farm, how is it part of the transportation system, it works through, there's all this processing. Energy and energy grid. We plug into the wall, we assume electricity is going to be there. Can a grade 4 student actually go to, you know, the atom back generating station and understand this is how electricity is made? Information and communication technology. By grade 4, your kids may have a mobile phone. I keep on Finland, I think they said that at birth from there. The idea that you can talk to a person at a distance, how does that really work? So from there, we go to a second class of systems. Systems that enable healthy, wealthy, and wise people. Building and construction is actually a service system. And people don't think about it. It's one of the world's largest service systems. And people think, well, what is it? You're not manufacturing products. So it's a service system. Take them out to a building site. Banking and finance, anyone that's on Bay Street recognizes the service industry. Retail and hospitality, obviously. And we take that for granted, but, you know, a hotel. What does it take to actually operate a hotel? Do you really know what happens in a retail environment? So my youngest son, I have 4 sons, my youngest son is currently is a co-op student from Ryerson, and he's spending a term at Canadian Tire headquarters. And it's really interesting because these job coachings happen at Ryerson, they happen at the university, they're going, Canadian Tire, ooh, I want a job at Canadian Tire, I get a job at Google. I say, no, you don't want a job at Google, you want a job at Canadian Tire. You go to Canadian Tire, you will understand what it means to run a business. So he's in merchandising, he gives me these stories because he's doing line reviews on GPS devices. Like, he's talking about, you know, talking with Garmin and getting those and putting them in every Canadian Tire store in the country. It's like, he understands business and go, wow, they're learning so much. He's going, oh, working Canadian Tire. No, that's a service industry. Healthcare is really complicated. If people really understand how the health system works, it's one of the biggest things in the Ontario budget. And we really understand how it works. And worse yet, now you get to grade 9, education. Do people really understand how the education system works? What does that really mean? Like, if you've been in school for all this time, it's like being a fish immersed in water. You're in this education system, you really understand what that is doing or doing to you. And the last 3, systems that govern that are more complicated. The government of cities is actually the most concrete because you can see garbage picked up and these sorts of things. When you get to the regional, state, provincial level, it's a little more abstract, but it's pretty good. By the time you get to the federal level, it's like no one knows what the federal government does because it's all abstract. There's laws and, you know, things outside the country you don't see. So these are all service systems. So here's a skill testing question. For you, everyone in this class, who is not working in a service industry? Okay, if everyone in this, oh, you are working, what do you do?
I'm sorry, working not in a service
working industry? Not in a service industry.
Yeah, an industrial company.
You work in an industrial company. Yeah. Okay, so we have, here's the statistic. We have one person in the room who's not working in the service industry. So, what are you studying? You're studying stuff that came from the manufacturing mentality. And it's like, oh, okay, so, and one of my favorite things is you use this term, and you're going to use this with caution. When everyone says, we need a mechanism to fix that, How about saying we need an organism to fix that? Here's the definition. It comes from the Institute for Manufacturing at Cambridge. And I've broken it down into a little word gram so it can kind of follow through. A service system is a dynamic configuration of resources. Those resources are people, technology, organization, shared information. A service system creates and delivers value. The value is through service, and the value is between a provider and a customer. A service system can be a complex system. There's the term system there. The system has interactions. The interactions are between the provider-customer, the customer-customer, and the supplier-supplier. So that's the rigorous definition, and I like the definition, because you'll find that there are people in the service science community that understand systems. There are a lot of people within the service science community that do not understand systems thinking. And so we end up with this interesting split of trying to pick who you actually cite and who you don't cite. Here is one of the people that really understand systems. So Rafael Ramirez, he's actually not known for the service stuff. Rafael Ramirez is a professor at Oxford now. His background before that was he was a scenario planner at Shell. So those who didn't do scenario planning, so Shell is one of the big stories, one of the people that were there. Before he did that, he was actually a graduate of the social system science program at York University. As you go through the history, Rafael Ramirez, you'll actually find articles, he was at York University for kind of his first stint when he was teaching. So he's been around the world. But I actually asked Rafael, I got introduced to him with a friend, so when I go to the UK, I stopped by. And I was asking him one day, and I said, do you use system thinking in your everyday work? And he says, of course I do. And I said, how? And so he said, the way that you do scenario planning is, probably two matrices, right? How do you pick those dimensions? Those dimensions are designed as a Singerian inquiring system. And he said, you're the only person in the world that actually understands what that means. That's in the fifth part of this talk that I'm not going to get to today. But it's in the design of inquiring systems. So there are ways of doing scenario planning that are system thinking, but most people don't understand what that is. And there are, I said, lectures about that on the web. You can try to dig them out. But let's go back to this idea. In service systems, in service science, there's kind of two camps. If you read about this, there's a camp that's called service dominant logic. Service dominant logic is done by Steve Barco, who's in Hawaii, and Bob Lush, who's in Oklahoma. Bob Lush is an old retailing guy. Steve was a PhD student who developed this idea of service dominant logic. And he says, there's two ways to do services. Like I asked him, do you know about the Rafael Ramirez stuff? Of course. He says, yeah, well, why do you not use his terms? He says, okay. There's two ways of doing research. One is use a term that everyone thinks they understand, and you overload it. So you spend your time saying, I'm doing service science. And then people go, what do you mean by services? You spend all your time explaining services. The other way of doing it is you create a whole new vocabulary which people don't understand, which is really clear, but then you have to train a new vocabulary. So the case for Rafael Ramirez and the people that worked around him, particularly Richard Norman, was they came up with this idea of what they called an offering. An offering has three dimensions. An offering has physical content, service content, and people content. So we talk about automobiles, you've got the physical car, you've got the services like the warranty that comes with the car, and you've got the people who are people that would help you on a long-term basis, OnStar, you can phone in, you've got people interacting, that's what I think. And this created this interesting framework, which is now we're thinking about systems. If you have an offering, is the offering a part of an input to a system or an output to a system? So we have an offering as output, we have this industrial logic, we have a car, the customer value is created through the transaction. So in this case, this is the traditional automobile industry. They make the car, it comes off the end of their factory line, you buy the car, you own it. The transaction is done. What we can do is instead look at shifting this to a service logic where we say, well, actually, we're valuing you not in the transaction, but in the long-term relationship. So this service logic says, we'll lease you a car. You don't have to own it, we'll take care of the maintenance and that sort of stuff. And if you work through the logic of that, if they take responsibility, they are in it for the long term. Now, if you actually look at automotive companies actually don't make their money off of the automobile. They make the money off the financing. It's actually the same in a lot of other industries. So of course, in GM, you have General Motors Financing. At IBM, IBM Global Finance. IBM Global Finance probably makes more money on the money than they do on the computers. So you end up with a lot of industries that are doing this, where they have the service logic. If you're going to transactions, you can also have the offering as input. And so, as opposed to doing everything for them, the person that's involved, your customer, has to actually engage with the service. In this case, you have offering as input. So an ATM, a bank machine. What's happened is they've taken something where they actually managed all the money and they gave you cash or stuff like that, and now you go and you punch in the numbers. So if there's a mistake made, whose fault is it? If you're at an ATM, it's you punching in the numbers and it's like, oh, I can't remember my password, I just did the wrong thing. But it's not like being in front of a teller and saying, you made a mistake, right? Fix it. There's this last category of partnership logic. In this case, it's offering as input and this customer value through relationship. And this is an interesting long-term sort of thing on joint ventures and research projects. Yes?
Sorry, I'm just confused a little bit between what you mean by output and input. I think I'm just, like, I just misunderstood.
Okay, system has an input and has an output. Okay, so you have a supplier system and you have a customer system. So when you're talking about the car, it comes off General Motors.
So you're talking about who the, like, when you're talking about input and output, you're talking about
the supplier.
Like who is doing the inputting and the outputting, or could that change?
So you have the idea of the offering. So you have the package, which is physical service and people content. So General Motors has an offering. At IBM, it's always interesting when they start percolating. IBM, the vocabulary we see announcement letters, they announce offerings because it's always hardware and software and services associated with it. So the offerings could come from the customer side, but generally offerings come from the seller side, right? So if you look at a house, a house can be an offering, but it's usually not initiated by the customer. Usually you don't go knock on a person's door and say, I want to buy your house. And I just, no, go away, right? So it usually is on the seller side things happen. So we're talking about input and output, but this one is mostly on the seller side. But there's now this general idea you're talking about, which is important systems. How do you draw the boundaries of the system? Right, so if it's purely transactional, then you are drawing the boundaries and saying, okay, General Motors is the boundary. When the car leaves General Motors, that's it. There's nothing else to do with it. But when you start taking the customer relationship perspective, it's like, well, it doesn't really leave the system. When you've leased the car, it's now a co-production system where the customer is giving money and they're driving the car and GM is doing ongoing maintenance. So now you've redefined the system.
That makes sense to me for like this column and this column. Where I'm still confused is this column and
that column. Yes, yeah. So, if can you define the offering as an output, or is it an input to someone else's system? So, in the case, so let me give you the example. I worked in consulting at IBM, and there was also a research division, and people you get IBM researchers working on projects. There are two ways to do this. So if I was going to do this as offering as output, as a consultant for IBM, I would engage with you and I say, here's what we're going to do. At the end, you will get this deliverable, you get this report, we'll have this content. And then I can leave. Right? I can bring you people from IBM research, but now the deal is different. Firstly, I don't guarantee you any results. This is research. This is not a consulting project. So IBM will work with you on this new technology. And we're going to, at the end of the project, IBM may develop a product out of it, or may not develop a product. You can have whatever assets we jointly develop, because you contributed to it as much as we contributed to it, but it's like, we're maybe not something we're going to productize, right? So now it's an input to you that you can do something with. And you go, yeah, we're going to learn from IBM, and then we'll do our own thing. Or you could say at the end, no, we don't want that. We actually want the output because supporting software on an ongoing basis is a big pain. I'd rather buy something. I started consulting, I actually moved back in sales. And it was interesting being at one sales meeting where the software guy was, a software sales leader was saying, you know, simple customer relationship? Forget it. I don't want that. IBM wants the money. I'm selling you software. And I want the revenue. I don't care about partnership. You know what partnership means? Partnership means at 9/11, when Air Canada gets grounded, IBM takes a hit. And why is that? It's because IBM is in a partnership with Air Canada. The world's largest account in transportation and travel for IBM is Air Canada. Not Lufthansa, not American Airlines. It is Air Canada because all the people at Air Canada tend to be IBMers. Like, it's a partnership. They do everything. Air Canada doesn't work with anyone else. They only work with IBM. So when 9/11 happened, you don't go and complain, you guys aren't giving us enough revenue. I'm going down with you. And you know, airlines come around, that's a long-term sort of thing. And so people that think about partnership logic is kind of like, there's a downside to this. It's not a positive. It's a different model. It's a different architecture when you are doing this. You make a decision. Once you get into it, you can design all the details, but it's a completely different architecture and way of working in the company. Okay, I'm going to introduce this idea of affordances. Now this goes to the question, how many people have been to design school? How many people know what an affordance is and think they know what an affordance is? Okay. I'm going to run through this, and I'm going to run through this in a particular way, and I'm going to link that to the pattern language stuff that I've been doing. So there's this book called A Pattern Language in 1975. If you meet any architecture student who doesn't know what it is, then they're really up the rocker. It's in every library in the world. You can go across all the library, it's there. The OCAD library should have a pattern language. If it doesn't, then they should be shocked. The idea that came out in the 1970s, there's this architect builder named Christopher Alexander. And Christopher Alexander created this idea of a pattern language because the question was, how do you design a good house? And the pattern language has the subtitle, Towns, Buildings, and Construction. So how is he designing what he called living buildings? You know, buildings that are nice to be in. So we're having a discussion, just talking to this class. You guys are in this classroom, the upstairs classroom, 510. Is it like a nicer room? Why is it nicer? You know, how is it that you actually design it that's different? And so we have these patterns. Now, one of the patterns he has in the book, as an example, is light on two sides. If you have a room, it's a good idea to have light on two sides. You have windows on two sides. People love corners. Right? It's so much better. Well, why is it that you have light on two sides and better than light on one side? What is a balcony? You know, a balcony is something that is like kind of deep so you can go out, but not so deep that it's part of a big structure. I have all these sort of patterns in there people recognize. So the book, A Pattern Language, has the pattern. A Timeless Way of Building has the processes to do that. So people in software, Timeless Way of Building is at the foundation of a lot of stuff that came into agile development. And all the stuff that was working around computer science in the 1980s, A Pattern Language is a book in computer science called Design Patterns of Reusable Software. IBM Research, John Lucidi is one of the people that did that. And then actually just working on user interface stuff, there's this new software called Pattern Lab for designing user stuff. I was at the Drupal meeting and I talked pattern labs. So obviously they're using patterns and using this idea that comes from Christopher Alexander. The third book, Our Oregon Experiment, is about the design of the University of Oregon campus. How do you design a campus that's a nice campus, you know, living, people want to go there? So most people would recognize a pattern language book. And in the last class, someone said, I have it sitting on the floor, it's on my bed. You know, that sort of thing happens. The Timeless Way of Building is less famous. Almost no one has an Oregon Experiment, but here's my advice. If you're interested in this stuff at all, don't read any of those. Read this book, which is a more recent book. It's his last book, and it has a gutsy title, The Battle for Life and Beauty of the Earth. So now he's really venting, he's an old guy. It's a story of 1985 of him going into Japan and building a school. It's in, it's out north of Tokyo. It's in Aishin School. How is it you design a joint high school college? That was the plan. Start off with a story about, they start off with tea fields, and they're out there and they're trying to do stuff. And he has all these conventions like, no blueprints. How do you design a whole university campus with no blueprints? And why would you do that? And the reason is that blueprints are instruction. They are a representation. When people develop blueprints, then it's like all of a sudden you've lost all the stuff about the land. And so he goes into Aishin, these tea fields, and the way you would normally do things would be like put a rock and say, okay, we're going to have this walkway, it's going to arc this way. And then you go on the land and you stand there and you go, no, we need to move it over like that much. Trying to do that on blueprints, it's like, no, you can't do that. So you're actually developing stuff on the land. Now, for those of you who are familiar with agile software development, agile software development doesn't do specifications. They do user stories. User stories, and then you go build stuff, and you come back in like, you have iterations where you come back with the client every 2 to 3 weeks. You have a sprint. That is taking the idea of Christopher Alexander and saying, do not write specifications. Do not write requirements. Do it on the land. So if you're doing it in software, you want the user to see it. And you go, the usual answer is, that's exactly what I told you to build me, and that's not what I want. Because now I see it. I see it on the land. And this path is curved. It's like, no, it's ugly. Move it this way, this might make a big difference. It also has a story of him grappling with things like importing redwood timber from California into Japan without having to work through the system that would have inflated all the prices, and then also dealing with the Yakuza, because the construction industry in Japan is embedded, let's put it that way. So here's a definition of a pattern. A pattern is a recurring structural configuration that solves a problem in a context, contributing to the wholeness of some whole or system that reflects some aesthetic or cultural value. You'll find, actually, if you dig in my blog, I wrote a long time ago, the stuff that I write in my blog is painful. I write stuff because when I'm grappling with stuff and I need to write, but it's not worth an article, I put it on my blog. And so one of the things was Christopher Alexander, systems thinker. And yes, absolutely, when we look at the beginning of his career, Christopher Alexander was a system thinker. He has an article called Systems Generating Systems. The idea was a pattern language would generate a system on which you would construct a place. So, this is a definition that actually comes from Jim Copley, and so we're now in computer science doing this. And he says, okay, here's the canonical form for a pattern. You have the pattern name, you have a problem, which is a specific problem to be solved, you have a context around that problem, you have the resulting complex after you've done, the resulting context after you've applied a solution. The solution is impacted by all these forces. So when you're talking about forces are, well, you've got the economics of this. The economics say that you can't go above this amount of money. Well, you start negotiating with, are you really hard and fast about that or not? You have physical constraints. You can't build a two-story building unless you put these foundations underneath, or four-story, or whatever. It has to be built. So there are all these sort of considerations that happen in architecting, not so much design, in architecting the system. You have the rationale explaining all of the why you're doing this, and you have related patterns, because when you're talking about pattern, it's related to other things. So one of my favorite patterns of Christopher Alexander is an alcove. If you design a long hallway, which is really great, what's going to happen? Well, it has to be a certain width. But when you have that hallway, people tend to walk that hallway, and then they meet each other, and then you've got now a roadblock in the middle of your hallway. So what you do is you design an alcove, people step out and go, oh, come over here for a second. You get out of the path of people, and you have a private conversation. There's an alcove. You can't have the alcove unless you have a corridor. You can't have a corridor, you should have an alcove. So So therefore, you've got a linkage between these sorts of things. Having a balcony, you know, balcony you have to have on the outside will require, you know, on the inside, the structures are going to pull it back so it doesn't fall over, a cantilever structure, these sorts of things. You've got all sorts of things all linked together. Now, I'm going to introduce to you the idea of an affordance. And I want you to think not about so much about the structure, because the structure, Peter emailed me this with email back, which I told him. Affordances is a term that requires a little bit of unpacking. And there's a little bit of an error for someone in the field who's pretty big, who is Don Norman. Don Norman was Apple fellow. He came in, did user interface design. So the trash can on a Mac interface is in effect from Don Norman's work. And so the idea was about an affordance. And so what is an affordance? Start with the example. An affordance is a doorknob on a door. What does a doorknob afford you the ability to do? A doorknob affords you the ability to pull on the door. If you have a door that swings both ways, putting a doorknob on that door is going to confuse people because, you know, it's got a flat plate on it, then you push, you know, you've got to push through, the door goes both ways. But if you do not have a doorknob on a door that's supposed to pull open, it's like you're missing something. Now, do you have to use the affordance? Well, you don't always have to use the affordance. So, you know, on a Mac interface, are there other ways to delete besides using the trash can? Well, you push the delete button. Select, hit the delete button, it should work, right? That's a logical sort of thing. You don't have to use the trash can. So it doesn't force you to work in a particular way, but it allows you to do something. So when you're looking for a term that's kind of like feature or function, affordance is an interesting way to look at design because you're enabling a different way of working with people. Now, here's where the confusion comes in, and Don Norman took years to revise this. So originally this came up in the design of everyday things, the psychology of everyday things when he wrote this stuff. People, when they're particularly doing web development work, they think the affordance is the trash can. The affordance is not the trash can. The affordance is the interaction between the person and the trash can. If the person sees the trash can on the screen and doesn't recognize that it's for deleting stuff, that's not an affordance. If a person sees a doorknob on a door and doesn't recognize it's for pulling, it's not an affordance. So this is a really subtle shift in the way you look at systems. It's about, in this case, the interaction you have within a system. It's not about the thing itself. Yes?
Would that be similar to sort of the idea of like choice architecture? So like the idea of building an environment in which people, that enables people to make certain choices or better choices, would it be?
Yeah, so using a great term, you are building an environment. You are not building the system, you are building the environment, yes. And again, so you start talking about designing. Are you designing it or are you architecting it? Because if you're architecting it, it's there and people may or may not use it. If you're designing it, you're now into saying, okay, this is the design, and you know, how are we actually going to make this doorknob? Is it square, shape, whatever? So there are many things coming. So affordances was developed by J.J. Gibson, and there's many readings for it. The term affordance refers to whatever it is about the environment that contributes to the kind of interaction that occurs. And there's more definition after that. But the idea of environment, it comes out. So we are still in systems. There's a system and environment, but you're not focused on them as separate things. You're focused on the interaction between the system and the environment. Now, if we go back to the service system example, we could talk about this in terms of high ability and low ability. So you can have the same service, but it's configured with different affordances for different people. So let's talk about health services, okay? So you can go in and there could be inpatient, there's outpatient, there's telehealth. Okay, so you actually don't have to go to a hospital. You want to talk to a nurse, you pick up the phone. That is an affordance. Is the affordance of telehealth essential to a medical system? Well, no, people can go and go line up at a hospital or, you know, whatever. then it clogs up your system. So can we design extra affordances so that people can use them or not use them? So telehealth is an affordance. Is it essential? That's a judgment call. You have high ability people and you have low ability people. So what does it mean for telehealth when the person that is going to call in doesn't speak English as their first language? Okay, is that an opportunity or is that a downside? Because on the one side, it's kind of like, okay, now they're going to have problems communicating. But the upside is telehealth could actually have multiple language support. And it'd be actually a better affordance than going to a hospital where it's like, does anyone speak Pakistani? It's like, oh God, you know, how are we going to deal with this? So you can actually design affordance in a different way. You can design it for a low ability person and a high ability person in different ways. So, you know, there's nothing worse, there's no worse patient than a doctor, right? Having a doctor come into an emergency room, that's a high ability person who's not going to be saying, don't do this, don't do that. Stop telling us what to do. You're not the doctor, you're the patient, right? As opposed to someone who can't come in and comes in and can't articulate, well, it feels sore. Well, what do you mean by feeling sore? Right? So there's different levels of building and how you design those services. Okay, now we're going to start wandering in. On my website, there's this paper. This is the one from October, Pattern Manifest Services Thinking. This is when I actually switched over and said, okay, Christopher Alexander, I want to focus on affordances, not on the buildings. Yes?
Can I ask you to just go back?
Go back,
sorry,
okay.
I know you're...
Yep.
Could you just talk about that service system box? So, like, I understand the difference between your beneficiaries being various abilities of interacting with the affordance,
mm-hmm.
but in that service system column?
Yeah. It's one system.
Yeah, so can you just talk a little bit about the difference between the input versus output for low and high? Like, what does that really mean?
Okay, so for a... let's go back to the banking example. So if you want money coming out of the bank, a low-ability person has to go see a teller,
okay.
Right? A high-ability person can contribute to the co-production by punching in on the ATM.
Okay.
Right? So I've had the interesting thing. So in October, I was here with Susan Osala, and she's now in Shanghai. And so it's like getting money out of China is a real problem. It turns out that when you actually take your bank card and you put it into the machine here, you can actually take money out of Chinese bank accounts. And so Susan is now going to start routing through Toronto just to get money out of China, which is pretty funny. But what happens when you put the card in the machine? It comes up and the interface is Chinese. She's like Australian Finn. This is not going to work. So we've now taken something that was supposed to be a high ability affordance, which was ATM. What do? We went into the branch. It's like, is there anyone in the branch who can read Chinese? And we pulled one of the tellers, because the teller can't do the transaction either. The teller actually would require you to put stuff in. So it's like, no. So the teller comes out down to the ATM and helps Susu get money out of the machine. It's the same service system. They did not build the affordance in China that when you try to take money out of a Canadian ATM, that you could actually do English. It's the same service system. So if the banking system worked well, the low ability person would normally just go into the teller and tell them, you know, here's my cash, here's my ATM card, can you give me money? You can't do that in Canada. That's a beautiful low ability sort of thing, according to a teller. And the system would totally fail. But it's all one service system. It's a banking system to withdraw money.
Okay, and it's like the underlying assumption that you want your beneficiaries of the service system to have more autonomy? Because it sounds like...
You have to design for all abilities.
Okay.
You have to design it. So you've now hit upon one of the key ideas and the differences between a production system and a service system. So a production system, Steve Heckel in Adaptive Enterprise talks about taxi cabs and buses. So a bus is a production system. A bus operates on the same route, it runs on a schedule, and it runs by that clock. It doesn't matter whether there are people who are on the bus or not on the bus. A taxi is a service system because when you get into the taxi, the first thing is they ask where you want to go, which is input from the client. And you can say, so I came across, actually yesterday morning I came across, and we saw on City Pulse, like, the streetcars were lined up across Queen Street. Don't go on Queen Street, go on Richmond. Yeah, but Queen Street's faster. No, no, go on Richmond. So the customer now has input into what the what they'll use the tools for.
Okay, thanks.
Any question? No? So I'm moving over to talking about this paper, which is what I'm building up to all this time. Essentially, the idea of pattern language has been that you design structures. So they are designing the doorknobs. And what I'm saying is, let's design the service system, and I want to use pattern language, but I can't use the pattern language the way Christopher Alexander intended it. I don't want to do doorknobs. I want to do the interaction between the person and the doorknob. So I have to make adjustments to the way pattern language is done. Now, this is from the 1968 book that Alexander first created. And this was a pattern language for multi-service centers. A multi-service center in 1968, it was a new program in the United States where they have drug users, they have poverty, and this the idea was, let's take all the services and put them in one physical place. So mental services, physical doctors, you know, all these sort of things, let's put them all in one place. Getting your license, losing IDs, put them in one place. So the one that I studied was actually in Bronx, New York. And what happens is you end up with this pattern language, and you see there's this cascade of patterns. So patterns depend on things, and the general idea is great because you have the idea of context. So a pattern language for a multi-service center that is done in the busy urban area is different from one that's done in the suburban area. In an urban area, you want to build where there's transportation hubs that people are going to be coming in or walking in. It's really dense. If you're a little bit farther out, you need parking spaces. You do not need parking spaces in an urban area, and actually they're going to work against you because of the forces you have to run those spaces on. So why do you want to use pattern language? There's three types of help. Firstly, it gives you full respect for the unique features of each special building. A pattern language is not something that you just come and say, I'm going to apply this pattern language. There's 253 patterns in a pattern language. It took them 10 years to write the book. And they all interconnect. And what happens is people say, I need a balcony. I need an alcove. Light on two sides of the room. That's what's most important to me. Yeah, I understand it's all those stuff, but you know, that's not really what it's all about. So you focus on specific patterns. It tells them which patterns to consider first and which ones to consider later. So there's ordering in the shearing later, pacing later sort of way. You have to get the site right before you start working with furniture. Worry about furniture, but later. We need the structure, load-bearing walls. It tells them which patterns go together, so he knows which one to think about, at the same time which ones are done separately. So when you're focused on big things, like you're still trying to get the site and structure in, it's like, guy comes in, talks about plumbing, not ready for you. Come back tomorrow. Right? That's the reason I like the general approach of pattern language. Now, the question that you asked about the who is the thing that's missing in pattern language. I'm going to go to the next slide because this one blows it up. This kind of traces through the paper. But what I want to talk about is adjusting the way we do pattern language. The pattern language was a solution to a problem in context. Pattern language is a solution to a problem in context. That's what Christopher Alexander wrote. I want to change that, and I want to change it to bring in affordances. So here's the format they're going to have. And this example is from the multi-service center. So in the paper and in Christopher Alexander's work, if you have a multi-service center, you need a place for the kids because a mother who's a drug user is going to come in and she has kids. Someone has to look after the kids while she's getting her psychiatric exam or whatever, right? So someone has to look after the kids. So he actually has built into the pattern language, a place to look after kids. But that's like saying, I need a doorknob. I don't want the doorknob, I want the interaction. How else do we change the interaction? So let's change the pattern label to something called like minding children. And it's an active sort of thing. Minding children is an ongoing sort of thing. It's not a state. It's not a coming in and going. And let's start off firstly with the voices on the issue. This is related to some of the stuff on issues, basically. Have you heard of Wicked Problems yet? Have you not buy this issue-based information system? Okay, you're missing the best part of a Wicked problem. It's not even in this lecture anymore. I took that one out. So, and this will be the history of science. So at Berkeley, when Wicked problems are being created by Horst Riddle, across the campus at Berkeley is Christopher Alexander doing pattern language. And the other person on campus is Wes Churchman, who was Russ Acoff's PhD supervisor. The three of them met, the students, the grad students that you meet there, they went to all three seminars. There are different approaches now. So Horst Riddle came up with issue-based information systems. Issue-based information systems are a rationalization of looking at a way of things, which is to say, we take an issue and we break it down, we end up with pros and cons, and you end up in what are now called argumentation schemes. The argumentation schemes say, you know, we would build this multi-service center because of this, and you end up with a tree structure, but the tree structure is not the same as what Christopher Alexander does. The Wicked Problems approach is a top-down approach that tries to decompose a problem. But it, first thing, it doesn't need to be a problem, which is good. It's systems, and this comes from the West Churchman side, and Russ Acoff. Russ Acoff would say that we don't look at problems, we look at systems of problems. A problematique. And Russ Acoff calls that a mess. So you start with this mess, this problematique. If you have a system of problems, you need a system of solutions, which is good for systems people, but then you get over to Christopher Alexander's camp who says, pattern is a solution to a problem in context. Okay, what do you mean by problem? And then you take the word problem over to Horst Riddle in Wicked Problems, and he goes, well, let's use the word issues, because an issue can be decomposed into problems. And so that's kind of all the background that goes into this. So when I say you have a voice on an issue, you've got a who and a what. So what's the issue here? What's the issue about minding kids? So for a client coming in, there's this issue, what services are available for me now and on appointment? So because I need to come in, maybe I can come in like after hours, someone else goes after my kids, and you guys don't have to worry about it. Or, you know, or you guys provide child care services, like that's sort of thing you worry about. Yes?
I was just wondering if we could just take a pause for a moment.
Sure.
I'm a little bit lost in terms of what this relates to.
Okay.
Okay.
So there is. So since 1968, there's all this work on architecture and pattern language, okay. Which people have actually forgotten what they shouldn't have, because you go to an architect and you talk to them about pattern language, they should use it. In the 1980s, in computer science, there's all this work about pattern language. And it's good in some respects, because when you're designing software, you are building structures that are somewhat permanent. And so you'd say, well, and enterprise architects, you always get the analogy, should you build a, should you build a software system like a house? We always talk about that. There was this discussion, Brady Booth says you should actually design software like a river and think about it that way, and already starting to go, well, maybe the idea of buildings doesn't really apply to software. When you get all the way over to services, it's like, okay, now it's like you have all these interactions. I've been talking about doorknobs, you know. If people come in and say, I'm going to design the doorknob, I'm saying you're missing the whole point of services. You're now talking about a production system, which is how do I build all these doorknobs? I don't care about the doorknobs. I care about the interaction. So it could be, right?
You mean the axis. The interaction isn't the axis.
The interaction between the actor and the thing. Yeah. So a service is now a thing. An offering is a thing. Right? But it's not a thing in the sense that people normally think about, because when you are in a service system, the customer is inside the system. When you're designing a system, there's always this question, do you put the customer inside the system or outside the system? System thinking is the most, boundaries is the first thing. In a production system, you can put the customer outside the system. The bus runs whether there are passengers on it or not. When you change to being a service system, all of a sudden the interactions come in and we say, well, okay, I don't care about this. We're going to run this taxi like a bus system. And you go, you're missing the point. Okay? Clear? Okay, so I have to adjust the pattern language. And so this is something that's taken actually 3 years. So this is why I had to go to the computer science conference, I had to go to the social change conference, I had to go to the architecture conference, because Christopher Alexander, like, I can't, people, the worst thing about, and I work in communities of practice and understand knowledge management, the worst thing about coming into a community is someone says, you obviously haven't read the literature and you don't know what I'm talking about. And what's happened is, because I've now actually gone back, and it's interesting, 3 years, I went to the architecture conference, and I put the YouTube video in, so I did the whole presentation in 20 minutes, so much I had. At the end of the presentation, you hear, I ask any questions, and you hear, wow. The wow came from Max Jacobson. Max Jacobson was one of the authors of A Pattern Language with Mr. Alexander. And I got to talk and experience with him and say, okay, and so he said, what was it like writing pattern language? He said, they have this rule, 253 patterns, 10 years to write them. In the pattern language, they have asterisks beside every pattern. Three asterisks means it's a real pattern. One asterisk means we think it's a pattern, but we're actually not sure. And he said that they were sitting, and they all go in a funk. They have you have all these authors sitting in a room, and they're going, is it a pattern or not pattern? Is it making the book or not making the book? They said, you know, this deep funk, everybody goes, ah. You know, we have to agree it goes in the book, or we have to disagree that it doesn't go in the book, right? If we don't all agree, it doesn't go in the book. The pattern language is written in a book, but it shouldn't have been written as a book. It should have been written as a wiki. More history of science. So, when the pattern language in software development created, the Design Patterns book, Ward Cunningham was a member of that community, and he invented the wiki. Why did he invent the wiki? It's because they were trying to write patterns, but all patterns are connected to other patterns. And so he invented the wiki as a way of doing that. Now, there's a whole other story about Ward Cunningham working on Federated Wiki and working on that. But there's all these linkages about patterns, design, architecture, all this stuff that goes into history that people have forgotten because you end up being disciplinary. When you go in system thinking, you go, okay, let's understand all of them. Got to put them all together.
Wow, I'm so far behind.
Okay, so minding children. So the first thing is let's focus on the voices on the issues. We need to know the who, because when you talk about pattern language, Christopher Alexander has a discussion about quality. And this is one thing, in the first book it was called Quality Without a Name. And eventually, like within 25 years, eventually he called it living. And what's the guy trying to do? He's saying, well, there's a space we like. There's a quality in the space that we like. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, it's a living space. And you end up with these sort of arm waving sort of thing. What is it that you're trying to do here? And when you're doing that in built environments, that's because he treats everyone the same. Christopher Alexander has this thing, you have the carpet experiment. He has a whole book on Turkish carpets. And in effect, the question is, there are two carpets here. There's a one on the left and there's a one on the right. Which do people prefer? And it turns out that almost everyone prefers the carpet on the left. And so who are the people that prefer the carpet on the right? Apparently only computer science people like the carpet on the right. They don't know why. And so they treat this aberration. But it's like, Christopher Alexander, if you build a great space, it is the same great space for everyone. In a service system, that's not what it's all about. A service system has the person in the system. Going to a restaurant is a really interesting experience for me because I come from a restaurant family. I like cooking at home. So when I go to a restaurant, I want to have stuff that I don't do at home. So it's like when you go to the restaurant, the first thing is there any fish on the menu? Because I normally don't cook fish at home, right? So that's not how most people think. But when we're going to the interaction, it's like, if we're talking about restaurants, I want to make sure that at least have an option of choosing fish. So, start with a voice on the issues. What is the issue they're concerned with? So, for a parent, what can I do with my kids while I'm busy? For a child, the child is also a voice on the issue. The child also has concern because what can I do? I want to play. So the affording value, how do you describe the affording value? Leaving a child at a supervised play area so their whereabouts are known, availing distractions for toddlers through teens so they come into the parents' less of a chore. You have spatiotemporal frames. Now this is part of the context, and this is where things get really subtle, is that I place context in three ways. There's firstly the spatiotemporal context of where and when, and you don't have to think about when or where in the idea of affordance. Because it could exist, the doorknob is there, but I don't see it. The when and where means that they see it. So there's interaction. The affordance is that facilities and programs are known to children and parents in advance of appointments. If I didn't know there was child care in the multi-service center, then you know I would have made other arrangements. You get there and go, oh, I didn't have to do that. I could just have my kids here. I didn't have to, you know, go through all this babysitting routine and, you know. Then you've got two ideas. So you've read the article on panarchy, right? Yes, not? It was assigned to you a couple weeks ago? So in panarchy, there's an idea, and I'll come back to it a little bit, of contained systems. Contained systems are slower and larger, and there are contained systems that are smaller and faster. And so we have to think about the systems and how they operate. I will come back to that in a minute. And I don't have time to do this. On the next page, if you decide to do a pattern language approach, here's the prescription for doing the pattern language approach. And it's in the research paper as well. But I have, like, you actually try to not use verbs, you try to use verbs rather than nouns, and you try to structure things. So I need to move on because I have a little more explaining for you before you get ready for this stuff.
So, David, do you want to, I don't want to cut this short, but these guys are probably getting to the point where they're about to overflow.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say, maybe we should take a break, and I'll give you a little bit of time after the break.
Okay.
Maybe after
okay, sure.
Does that work for you guys?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.